This is The Source on KSTX 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a law that banned gun ownership for those convicted of domestic violence, even if it's a misdemeanor charge. The decision was a major blow to those who see a constitutional right for gun ownership as virtually absolute. And for those who are concerned about family and gun violence in America, this was a major victory. But what are the implications and the realities of this decision? Do you support this Supreme Court decision? Do you think that the court should continue to find ways to limit gun ownership? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. Or do you think this is one that the high court got wrong? We want to hear from you, especially. Please call in, 210-614-8980. And email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet us at tprsource. We're joined here in the studio by Nyla Fuller. She's the legal director for the Family Violence Prevention Services Incorporated. And also with us on the line, Lindsay Nichols, the senior attorney for the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Welcome to The Source, Lindsay and Nyla. Hi.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you, David.
So, Nyla, let me ask you off that. When you heard this decision from the Supreme Court upholding this law, did you have a reaction?
I did. I was glad that the ban now applies not only to intentional crimes of domestic violence, but also to reckless crimes of domestic violence. And I believe that was the issue before the court, whether those who were convicted of acting recklessly and causing injury to a victim would also be banned from being able to have a gun. And I believe their argument was probably about the fact that being reckless is not the same as being intentional, that intending to commit a crime is much worse than being reckless and having your reckless behavior result in an injury.
So, Lindsay, can you kind of tell me more about that? What does that mean?
Yeah, so many crimes involve requiring the prosecutor to prove some sort of mental state that the person did what he did, intending to do it or purposely or knowing that something bad was going to happen, or just in the term that's generally used is in conscious disregard of whether somebody's going to get hurt.
So like if someone slams a door and says, well, I didn't know your hand or your head was in the door at the time, and so it was a reckless act and not a deliberate act.
Right. So, and the big deal here is that many crimes of domestic violence fall within that gray area, and the law itself doesn't require the prosecutor to make a distinction. The prosecutor can just prove that it was reckless without proving that the abuser acted intentionally and still get a conviction. So the real question was whether that conviction then disqualifies the person from possessing guns under a federal law.
So Lindsay Nichols, what did you think when the Supreme Court ruled to uphold this law? Were you anticipating this?
Yes, we were anticipating this. There have been other cases in which the court has interpreted this federal gun prohibition broadly, and that's in keeping with what Congress really intended when it enacted that law in the 1990s. Congress really wanted to close some loopholes so that domestic abusers wouldn't have access to guns. And one very important thing about these domestic violence laws is that in 35 states, they don't make that distinction between intentional conduct and reckless conduct. So, for example, if a person throws a plate against a wall near his spouse, he may not know that it's going to hit her, but he's being reckless about it, whether it's going to hit her or not. And that's the example the court uses to say, well, that person shouldn't have a gun, and the law, you know, is intended to cover situations like that.
The court ruled by a vote of 6-2, so the absence of Scalia would not have made a difference here, obviously. But it was Justice Thomas and Justice Sonia Sotomayor, they were the two dissenters. And is there anything to read into that, Lindsay?
I don't think so. I think Thomas is concerned primarily about the Second Amendment. And I think the rest of the justices, you know, underlying this opinion is this feeling that, well, there's not really a Second Amendment issue here because the people These are not law-abiding gun owners, right? These are people who have committed a crime. They've been convicted of a crime, and the question is really whether that conviction falls within this law. So Thomas is the only one who is sort of preoccupied with that Second Amendment issue, which really isn't an issue really among the courts generally within this country very often. We've seen that over 90% of Second Amendment challenges to gun laws tend to be rejected. So that's in keeping with that trend. And Sotomayor is a little bit more interesting. The opinion suggests that she's just really trying hard to narrowly construe criminal laws generally and not specific to gun laws. And that's sort of her special, what she wants to bring to her jurisprudence, I think. But it's an interesting question, and certainly both of those views are not held by the majority of the justices.
But is this a lifetime ban on gun ownership if you are convicted of a misdemeanor domestic violence charge, Lindsay?
Yes, that's right. Under the federal law, it's a lifetime ban.
And so someone 19 years old does something, and then they're going to be held to the standard all the way through the rest of their life. So it shows you this is a serious charge. You know, they're losing a constitutional right due to that misdemeanor conviction.
Yeah, absolutely. And what this law was really a reaction to was this evidence that domestic abusers are very dangerous and they're not being convicted of felonies. And very often, you know, the courts were convicting them of misdemeanors instead of felonies, even though the behavior was just as dangerous, and the people were just as dangerous to the public safety in the future. So as a result of that, the Congress decided that they have to be banned from possessing guns in the future because that behavior is so dangerous. And that is truly in keeping with the evidence. I mean, we know that victims of domestic abuse are 5 times more likely to be killed by their abuser if the abuser has a gun. And that kind of risk to women and children who are being abused is just too great, and just not consistent with public safety.
Right. And so when we come back from our break, our phone lines are open, 210-614-8980. You want to hear from our listeners. What do you think about this ruling from the Supreme Court? What do you think about this domestic violence, a misdemeanor charge, a conviction being enough to prevent someone from being able to own a gun for the rest of their life? And how does this stack up? You know, here in Bexar County, we'll hear some statistics about domestic violence. We invite you into our phone conversation. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. The Supreme Court rules that people convicted of domestic violence lose their right to own a gun. The recent decision shocked supporters of the Second Amendment, but is welcomed by those who are fighting for the rights of those dealing with family violence. What are the implications of this decision? Does this mean that we now have a high court that's willing to stand up to the NRA? With me in the studio, Nyla Fuller, legal director for the Family Violence Prevention Services, and also Lindsay Nichols on the line, senior attorney for the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. And Nyla, you see what happens here in Bexar County, the domestic violence problems that we have, and you have some statistics. Do we have a trend? What is the scope?
It seems I've looked at the statistics from the last about 5 years, beginning in 2011. In 2011, there were 102 women killed as a result of a domestic violence incident. In 2012, we went up to 114 women. In 2013, there was 119. In 2014, 132.
So that's a trend. It's getting worse.
Unfortunately, it is. In 2014, Bexar County had 5 domestic violence homicides. And according to the National Domestic Violence Hotline, San Antonio, for example, Bexar County is number 4 in the list of, going through number 1 as being the worst and down the list. San Antonio is number 4, based on the number of calls for help they receive.
And it's not just having this misdemeanor charge of a domestic violence will keep you from having a gun. You're also not supposed to be able to get a gun if there's a protective order that's been given against someone. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure.
What is a protective order?
A protective order is an order issued by a civil court. It does not require a criminal conviction, does not even require a police report. It's given by a court as a result of the party's testimony. And it's an order to stay away. If a protective order is issued by a court, then the alleged perpetrator is ordered to stay away from the victim. He or she cannot contact the victim, cannot go to the victim's home or place of business or work, cannot possess a firearm, cannot have access to the children, for example, if there are any children involved, or pets, if there are pets involved.
So they already own guns?
They might.
Okay, typically, okay, maybe they're a concealed license owner, they're perfectly legal on gun ownership, but then they get a protective order against them. Are they required to turn the gun over to someone else? What happens to that?
Yes, the protective order would prohibit them from being able to possess a firearm or have a license to carry a firearm for the duration of the protective order. Generally, protective order is good for 2 years. However, it depends on the court. It depends on the circumstances of the case. Potentially, a protective order could be a lifetime protective order.
But there's no actual determination what they have to do with that gun during that time. So you just can't have a gun. And so what do I do with it? Well, you're not required to give it to law enforcement. You're not required to do anything. You know, just not have it.
Generally, the protective order would not go as far as specifying what exactly you need to do. It would just have the prohibition against you possessing a firearm.
All right. Let's go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Claiborne is on the line. Claiborne, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I think this is the recent ruling is too much all or nothing. When I was in graduate school in Massachusetts, I had to get a protective order against an individual that I had been in a relationship with. In Massachusetts, one of those states where, because the other one I attempted to get against a guy when I was in undergraduate school against a guy because I was not in a relationship with or sleeping with him, you couldn't. That's how it was constructed. At any rate, make a long story short, we're both in the city of Boston, but she was in a different court jurisdiction. 2 days later, she managed to go get a conflicting restraining order. Luckily, mine was 150 feet. As opposed to her 60 feet, so there was no way I could ever be in conflict with that. But the BPD showed up. They removed my firearms. What eventually happened 3 years later, before any of this was ever resolved, was BPD just sent it off and melted it down kind of thing. There's too much all or nothing, not to mention there's a little too much that this is all male against female kind of thing.
All right, Claiborne, thank you for the call. Let me get reaction from Lindsay Nichols on that. She is the senior attorney at the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. What's your reaction to that story?
I can tell you that Massachusetts said that it happened in Massachusetts, and Massachusetts is one of the states with the strongest laws about guns in the country. By far, you know, that is an unusual state, and it sounds like possibly an unusual case in an unusual state. What happens to guns that are removed, first of all, even the removal of guns is something that's unlikely to happen in most states because most states don't have the kind of laws that very often let law enforcement officers do that. Some states do establish a process for making sure that people who become subject to protective orders surrender their guns. And often that says, you know, they can surrender them to a friend or a gun dealer just for safekeeping during that period of time. Massachusetts is stronger than those laws. Texas doesn't even have that minimal standard. So there's a big variety across the country in the ways these laws are administered. And I think overall, we need to strengthen those laws to make sure that there is a safekeeping process so that guns are kept. And that process should include the procedure for conducting a background check and returning the firearms at the end of the protective order.
But, you know, when we're talking about guns, it's not just always handguns. These are sometimes hunting rifles And then there are people who need guns for livelihood. They're law enforcement, or security guards, or they need them for their own protection because of the business that they're in. And so when you get a protective order or they get convicted of a domestic violence misdemeanor, then they've lost all that. That's all swept away, no longer part of their life. Nyla, and what's your reaction to that story?
That is correct. That sometimes is one of the unfortunate consequences of having a protective order issued against the alleged perpetrator. But the victim is safe. I mean, my purpose as an attorney representing victims of domestic violence would be to ensure that they're safe. And one of the ways to ensure that they're safe is to make sure that the other party doesn't have the weapons.
Okay, and so it's not just the protective order and now the domestic violence that's been reinforced, but also if you're out on bond, usually there is a condition in there that when you post bond, you're not going to have access to a weapon. And when you're out on probation, no weapon during that time as well. So there are areas of where the state says you cannot have weapons, and then the Supreme Court supports that. So, Lindsay, over at the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, should there be other areas that the high court or other state courts should be, state lawmakers should be looking at to curtail gun ownership?
There are certainly things that the legislators need to look at. We need to make sure, for example, that background checks are conducted whenever a gun is sold. And in most states in this country, that's not the law.
But if you do a background check, are you going to turn up the misdemeanor of domestic violence?
That's an excellent question. In fact, the Government Accountability Office issued a big report just yesterday on that topic and found that only 22 of the 50 states were actually flagging domestic violence misdemeanor records in the background checks to make them identifiable through the background check system. And what the result of that is that over the last decade, over 6,000 domestic abusers got a gun, even though they were going through a background check. The background check couldn't identify that they had been convicted of those domestic violence misdemeanors. So that record reporting issue and making sure the background check system can actually identify those people is a big problem, and there's a lot more work to be done.
There's also the issue of, like, how we define domestic violence. And I know that, at least in Louisiana, that the state lawmakers are dealing with that issue. The NRA is supporting no longer defining domestic violence as an incident between dating partners who are not cohabitating.
Right. That's another big loophole in the federal law. It has a limited definition of domestic violence so that dating partner who has been convicted of assaulting his ex or his current girlfriend still is able to possess a gun, still is able to pass a background check because that relationship doesn't fall within that federal definition. So some states are taking action to close that particular loophole as well.
And some states are trying to close it, and some states are trying to widen it.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, then a similar loophole involves convictions for stalking, where there isn't really a domestic relationship except maybe in the mind of the perpetrator. Those kinds of convictions often don't lead the person to be disqualified from possessing a gun.
Right. So these are areas that can be shored up to prevent further violence. And I know we had that call also from saying that this was weighted heavily against men. And Lindsay, is that your thought as well? Or how do we talk about that?
Well, that is really a loophole. I've seen some laws, some bills and also some laws actually enacted that have expanded the protections for victims to victims of the same sex. You know, that is something that happens often. I mean, there's similarly a situation with children. I mean, very often the victim is a child of either sex, so the law has to be broad enough to cover sort of all those situations.
And so Nyla over at the Family Violence Prevention Services, men and women? Is it, you know, does that make a difference in how this law is brought to bear?
Well, the Texas Family Code does not make a distinction. A victim of domestic violence, regardless of gender or sexuality, could obtain a protective order against the alleged perpetrator if he or she meets the standard. However, it is true that most domestic violence crimes are perpetrated by men against women, statistically.
Well, that's just the reality.
Yes, most of my clients are females.
Right, and it does happen that sometimes that women do perpetrate domestic violence against men.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's the law is there to protect them equally.
Absolutely.
Okay, all right. So I want to thank both of our guests, Nyla Fuller. She's the legal director for the Family Violence Prevention Services Incorporated. Lindsay Nichols, the senior attorney for the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Thanks both of y'all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And when we come back from the NPR news break, how a little vial of a chemical used by law enforcement to detect drugs can give a number of false positives, what that means to people, thousands and thousands of people across the state of Texas, their lives are thrown into turmoil because of that false positive. This is the source on KSTX. We'll be right back.